Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum, a venue for spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. Mycologist Paul Stamets calls fungi the soil magicians of nature. He says they were the first organisms to come to land 1.3 billion years ago. Stamets has spent his career searching for ways to learn from nature's secrets to heal humans and the planet. One focus of his research is Northwest mycelium. Over the years, he has filed 22 patents for mushroom-related technologies, including fungal pesticides that trick insects into eating them, and mushrooms that can break down the neurotoxins used in nerve gas. In this talk, Stamets discusses the broad range of species that exist on this planet. He offers insights into how fungi can boost the health of people and the environment. And he explains the relationship between the dwindling diversity of fungi, the colony collapse of honeybees, and how knowledge of both could help save our ecosystem. Paul Stamets is a renowned mycologist, author, and advocate for bioremediation and medicinal mushrooms. His work was featured in the documentary film, The 11th Hour. He spoke at Town Hall Seattle on May 4th, 2015, at an event hosted by The Common Acre. Thanks to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording.
Well, I'm so honored that you all came to see this talk, and I am greatly honored that I am here in this lifetime sharing this lifetime with you. I'm going to give a talk that's a rather rapid pace. I have a lot of material to cover, but I'm hoping this talk will forever change your lives for the better. I hope it will give you a new sense of optimism and understanding about the importance of the biodiversity of nature. So before I jump into my talk, a lot of you are wondering probably about this very cool hat that I have. I like this hat. It makes me look handsome. I'm balding, so that helps too. This hat actually is made from a mushroom called amadou. Amadou is a hard wood conch. It's a birch polypore. Its Latin name is Fomes fomentarius. Now, amadou allowed for the portability of fire. There's no doubt that we all came from Africa about 40,000 years ago. We went north and we discovered something new called winter. Oops. This mushroom, when you hollow it out, you put embers of a fire inside and carry fire for days. And the firekeeper of tribes know now more symbolically, but not too long ago, from a very practical point of view, the firekeeper literally held the life and death of the clan in his or her hands. This mushroom, when you boil it in water, it delaminates into mycelium. And some ladies in Transylvania made this hat. And that is an example of the thread of knowledge that goes over generations. How many of those threads have been cut because of war, disease, religious strife? You know, we are here today because of the benefits and the knowledge of our ancestors who created a body intellect of knowledge to get us to where we are now. So this mushroom also was a very first source of an antiviral from a mushroom against the tobacco mosaic virus. And moreover, beekeepers would use this mushroom for smoking hives for hundreds of years. So this mushroom and this hat is very flammable, so if somebody's smoking a cigarette, or now in Washington we can say smoking a joint, woof, my hat can catch on fire, and then that would not be good. So I want to introduce another little mushroom, a friend of mine. And this is agaricon. Agaricon is the longest living mushroom in the world. It was first described by Dioscorides as Elixirium ad longum vitam, the elixir of long life, thought to be useful as a treatment against consumption. This mushroom only grows in the old growth forests of Northern California, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, a few sky islands in Europe. But with the old growth forest being cut down, this mushroom cannot survive. I present to you, and I will try to make the case to you today, that agaricon has as much significance, if not more, than amadou in helping humans survive as we go into the future. So, I'll put this down so it doesn't fall. Okay, so, are you ready? We're gonna rock and roll, but we have now entered into 6X, the sixth greatest extinction event known in the history of life on this planet. But this extinction event is not caused by an asteroid impact. It's being caused by an organism, by us. Not only are we the cause of this extinction event, but we're likely to be its victim. Now, we have 8.3 million species on this planet. We're losing about 30,000 species per year. So do the math. In 100 years, we'll lose more than a third of the biodiversity of the organisms on this planet that have gotten us here today. So we are now experiencing a tremendous extinction event. But, you know, if an asteroid was coming to the Earth and slamming it in the next 6 months, I think there's a Bruce Willis movie on this, all the nations of the world would gather together to unify to prevent this extinction event from occurring. Unfortunately, this extinction event is happening over a few hundred years. Geologically, that's just a blip in time. But unfortunately, because of our political situation and the myopia that we live in our 75 to 95-year lifespan, we can't see it coming. Some of us can. But I believe there is a way to help us overcome this extinction event, and it's the way and the path of the mycelium. So the theme of my talk is biodiversity is biosecurity. And I sincerely and deeply believe in that. As Bob mentioned, I received the AAAS award. This is an astonishing award. It came out of the blue. You know, it was highly vetted. I had to go through a ritual of peer review. And I was really excited to get this award. My brother John, you know, lives in Seattle. My mother lives in Seattle. Many of you, probably some of you know my brother John. And my brother John and I were always competitive. He was the older brother. And so I was always trying to prove to him my science is legitimate, you know, but he was, you know, older brother, younger brother conflict. And I got really excited when this award came. And so I got this award, and I thought, oh my gosh, I've been vetted by the most prestigious scientific organization in the world. And they gave me the ambassadorship award. So I got really excited, and I called my brother up, and there's no answer. So I sent him an email, you know, John, I got to talk to you. I got this amazing announcement. And I didn't hear from him. And that was the day they discovered his body. John Stamets died from cardiac arrest standing up. I don't know if he got the email or not. But John inspired me to get into science, and so I'm dedicating all my talks to my brother John for the next year. And John and I grew up in a small town in Ohio, and we had a massive laboratory in the basement, 3 racks of chemicals. My father was a lieutenant on the aircraft carrier, the Intrepid, and so we got the Intrepid aircraft carrier radio. And so I had put in big cathode ray banks, you know, listening to coded messages behind the Iron Curtain. It was just fabulous, but my brother John would not let me play in the laboratory. I was the youngest of the family, and I wanted to blow things up. And he was a serious scientist. And so I always envisioned, well, I'd love to be a scientist living in the country, living my dream. And I feel like I'm doing that to a great degree now. So this is to my brother. I dedicate this talk to him. And all of you have brothers and sisters, most of you do. And, you know, my message is to you is, you know, the 25% of the time they you off, think about the 75% of the time that you dearly love them. You know, reach out to your brothers and sisters. You know, anything can happen at any time. So, okay. So these are 4 mentors of mine. This is Dr. Daniel Stuntz, University of Washington, here in Seattle. Professor Emeritus, Dr. Alexander Smith, Professor Emeritus, University of Michigan. Catherine Skates from Post Falls, Idaho. These 3 individuals have passed on, and this is my professor from the Evergreen State College, Dr. Michael Bug. I came into the field of mycology really in this group around 1975, 1976. And these were politically conservative individuals, and this is what I look like. Your suspicions are now confirmed, okay? Okay. So we spend a lot of time in the old growth forest. Now, I have a great group of individuals, some of whom are here. We spend a lot of time exploring the old growth forest. It's a library. It's an ancient library of strains. But looking at the cross-sections of habitats, oh, you see trees, you see soil, but saprophytic fungi rot logs. Then the endophytic fungi are inside of trees and plants and grasses, and they run parallel to the cells, and they're also in the leaves. Hundreds of endophytic fungi can exist cooperatively inside of a single tree, giving a host defensive resistance against pathogens and disease. The mycorrhizal fungi extend the root zones enormously. This is a mycologically astute audience. I think most of you know that. And the parasitic fungi, you know, are coming through the forest, and those with weakened immune systems, they exploit, they take advantage of. But this is really important for you to understand that all plants are part fungi. And scientists for years thought these threads of mycelium they would see when they do sectioning of plants under the microscope, that they were contaminants or parasites. It took a long time to understand, no, these are guilds. These are vast communities that are working quite cooperatively. And one book I highly recommend is Mycorrhizal Symbiosis. There's a little pine tree, this is the roots, and this is the extension of the mycelial network that creates a rhizosphere that's far larger than that of the physical plant roots itself. And this article came out in 2013, and it's an astonishing revelation, and it saddens me that we're finding this out now. But a simple experiment. There was four bean plants that were put into different individual pots. And the first bean plant was exposed to a group of aphids, and the bean plant then immediately, the first bean plant, produced alkaloids that were anti-aphid to defend the plant against this parasitic organism. The other three plants, when the first plant was exposed, did not upregulate those alkaloids. Well, then they did another experiment, and they put all the bean plants together in the same soil. And when the first bean plant was exposed to aphids, all the other bean plants upregulated the alkaloids, which were anti-aphid, communicating via the mycelium in the root zone, thus proving that these plants are communicating subterraneously. So what does the mycelium look like? It has lots of different forms, but it's exquisite in its branching. And these are literally growing under your feet and upon every footstep that you take on the ground. Well, people look at fungi and they think of molds on an orange or something like that. But the ecotype of an orange is just this the size of a small sphere. And these forest fungi grow over thousands of acres, and they're not limited in that sense. So I'm going to take you to where the largest organism in the world is. It's in southern Oregon, or eastern Oregon. And this is a mycelial mat, 2,200 acres in size, 1,665 football fields, and it's one cell wall thick, surrounded by hundreds of millions of microbes trying to gobble it up. And yet it is able to achieve the largest mass of any organism in the world. How does it do that? It's because it's in constant biomolecular communication with this ecosystem. And these fungi are growing through all woodland environments, all grassland environments. There's mosaics of these mycelial mats creating guilds of organisms and cross-communication between the members in the ecosystem. Now, this is what I call happy mycelium. This is mycelium running. This is, as a cultivator, this is the way we like to see this constant divergence. Well, in fact, you know, can these network-based organisms be considered intelligent? Well, a group of Japanese did a very interesting experiment with a slime mold. Now, they reproduced the cities around Tokyo. This is Tokyo. The slime mold is put there. These are little sub-cities around Tokyo. And they inoculated it, and 5 hours later, the slime mold's growing out. And then, you know, 11 hours later, it makes contact with all these little oat flakes that represent the other cities around Tokyo. And then in 26 hours later, it shuts down all the non-essential routes, consolidating its resources, and redesigned the Japanese subway system in a more efficient way than is designed today. Moreover, when they did mathematical analysis, they realized that the slime mold had achieved a near mathematical optimum. Now, why wouldn't it do that? Over hundreds of millions of years of evolution, it would conserve energy, it would become more and more efficient through trial and error. But I think this is one of the examples of the natural intelligence that occurs in the organisms around us. The mycelium produces lots of different compounds. We share a more common ancestry with fungi than we do with any other kingdom. 650 million years ago, we diverged from fungi. In fact, a group of scientists, 3 or 4 years ago, created a new super kingdom called Opisthokonta that joined Animalia and fungi together. We exhale carbon dioxide, we inhale oxygen. Some of our best antibiotics come from fungi to fight bacteria, but very few good antifungal antibiotics are out there because they're harmful to us because we share this close ancestry. The mycelium chose the route of going underground, externally digesting its nutrients. We chose the route of creating a cellular sac and then digesting our nutrients within. And that was the divergence of Animalia and fungi. I spent a lot of time under the electron microscope. These are some examples of mycelial mats. And then the mycelium then is triggered into mushroom formation. These little hyphal knots occur in response to primarily four environmental stimuli: a drop in temperature, an introduction of light, The mycelium comes to the surface when it's moist, when you have rain, exhales carbon dioxide, inhales oxygen. And these mushrooms are phototrophic. They require light in order to form. And then the primordia form, and so the mycelium can be resident in the ground for months, years, decades, centuries, and then the mushrooms then suddenly form, and over 5 days, the mushrooms form. So the mushrooms are fruit, and they're highly perishable. And the mycelium is resident in the ecosystem for a long time. It's got a host defensive immunity and an immune system that allows it to survive under adverse conditions, so it can produce these fruit bodies that then release spores. So the mushrooms then mature. In this case, the portobello-like mushroom spores are formed on the gills. And then the mushrooms invite microvores, people, animals, insects, birds, to come and consume it. And they, and by doing so, spread the spores. But I'm fascinated by the sequence of decomposition, because it struck me that these mushrooms are not just showing up and rotting for no purpose. There's got to be a sequence here. So as the mushrooms then rot in the old-growth forest here, and then several days later, my foot is covering approximately 300 miles of mycelium. In a single cubic inch, they can be more than a mile of these fine threads. And so looking at the mycelium, as my friend Patrick Hickey made these movies, and the mycelium then, it becomes polynucleate, and these bundles of nuclei go through the networks. And a swath of mycelium, the breadth of my arms here, there can be literally tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of end branchings that are polynucleate. There's more than one nuclei at the tips. And think of them as little scientists that encounters a new toxin, a new insect, a new type of wood, a new potential food source. If those genes recombine and a new enzyme or acid is created, where then it codes for that, then what happens, the mycelium surges, it consumes, it has a new food source, and then the information comes back channeled to the mother mycelium. So this knowledge becomes resident. Now I'm going to wax poetic here, but I absolutely believe in this. Looking at the organization of neurons in the human brain, looking at the organization of the computer, internet, it also conforms to the same archetype shared by mycelium in the brain and neurons. And I'm an amateur astronomer looking at the organization of dark matter. This is from a deep field view from the Hubble telescope. 180,000 galaxies are encompassed. And this is the dark matter then forms, according to string theory. This also conforms to the same archetype shared by that of the mycelium, the computer, internet, and neurons. And then when you take the greatest view of the universe and all the galaxies are strung together, it also conforms to the same mycelial archetype. And so when the universe was formed about 13.8 billion years ago, then the Earth then coalesced out of stardust around 4.5 billion years ago. And then the Earth became a solid. And then 3.8 billion years ago, the first life forms emerged. And they were unicellular, and they quickly became multicellular. And then we advanced to 250 million years ago at the time of Pangaea, a great cataclysmic event. It could have been an asteroid impact. Some theories say it's methane hydrate burst from the ocean. Some say volcanoes in Siberia. I don't see these as being mutually exclusive. They, in fact, may have been caused. The asteroid impact could have caused the earthquakes that created the fissures that released the methane hydrate gases. But nevertheless, the Earth was shrouded in dust. Massive extinction. Plants and animals died, and fungi inherited the Earth. They gobbled up those debris fields. So then we go to 65 million years ago, and this asteroid impact 250 million years ago, we think it was an asteroid impact, and then when the ecosystem was devastated, this fungus that arose, primarily the predominant one was Reduvio sporinides. It gobbled up the forest debris. And then we advanced to the time of Gondwana land, 140 million years ago. The continents separated, and then 65 million years ago, we did have an asteroid impact. We all know about this. And the dinosaurs became extinct, and the asteroid impact was right around the Yucatan. So the same thing occurred. The Earth was shrouded in dust. Sunlight was cut off. Massive extinction. And those organisms that paired with fungi had a better chance of survival, because fungi, again, re-inherited the Earth. There's a recurring theme here, folks. We experience and we approach extinction events. Our increase in survival is dependent upon pairing with fungi, and we should take the lessons from history and put these into place. So I'm very much into going into the old growth forces, my manly man picture. That's what I like to say. But I'm very interested in the decomposition of wood and straw. And first you have the wood, and then you inoculate it with the mycelium. Lots of things happen, and eventually you create soil. So fungi are the grand molecular disassemblers of nature. They're the soil magicians. They build soil. Now, I moved to this small waterfront farm in 1984. That's the location there. This is on Skookum Inlet, between Olympia and Shelton. trying to give Shelton some class. and I moved there, and I have to say, this photograph was very difficult for me to get. I hired an airplane. I went around the inlet three times. I couldn't get it because the window was in front of my camera. And I had this big Nikon camera, and so I told the pilot, I'm going to do one more. Take one more pass, and when I tell you, drop the wing, and I'm going to do something, but don't worry about it. And he goes, what are you going to do? And I go, I've paid you. And he goes, I paid you in advance. And he goes, yeah. And so he went around and said, now drop the wing, drop the wing. I didn't want to tell him. I opened up the door of the airplane, and I took off my seatbelt, and I lassoed my seatbelt, and I thought, but I didn't know it was a slip seatbelt. And I fell out of the airplane, and I had one hand on the seatbelt, one leg still in the airplane. I go, well, I'm here. I might as well take a photograph. So with all my strength, I pull myself up into the airplane. He goes, you're the first person who's ever left my airplane without a parachute, you know? But after I moved on this inlet, I was only here for 2 or 3 weeks. I bought a small farm, and it didn't have a septic system. It had a cedar tub. And after I moved here, 3 weeks, the sheriff showed up. I thought, that was awfully quick. I haven't unpacked yet, you know. But every landowner on this inlet received a summons that you had to replace your septic system with an engineer-approved septic system, or else you'd be physically vacated off the property. Well, what I did is I put in wood chips and a swale, and the mycelium would grow, and this is what it looks like. And it would be very tenacious, and the mycelium I put in was the garden giant mushroom, and it would hold the wood chips together, but there's all sorts of bacteria also growing. And so under the electron microscope, you can see the organization of mycelium is a natural filtration membrane. It creates these cavities that then swell with water, and it selects bacterial communities that are helpful to it in its conquest or is holding onto the ecosystem. The mycelium then is producing all these extracellular droplets. They're selective and harming preventing the bacteria that are harmful and then helping the bacteria that are commensal with the mycelium. So we started doing experiments, and so the water quality people came back 1 year later to my property. And they said, you know, I had cows, chickens, and pigs. They more than double. The bioburden increases. The amount of fecal coliform skyrockets, you know, as the animals reproduce. And they said, Paul Stamets, you know, what did you do? I said, because I was marked as a property that was a problem polluter of coliform bacteria going into the shellfish beds of Skookum Inlet. And I said, I put in these beds of wood chips. So he said, well, you have a very unusual result here. We've monitoring the water coming off your property, and you've had a 2-log reduction, a 100-to-1 reduction of coliform bacteria. I go, well, I think it's because I put in those wood chips and I inoculate it with mycelium. So this story goes through starts and stops and all sorts of problems. But we've developed this method that's highly modular that we can now grow mycelium in mass. And we can use these totes from the seafood and the fruit industry. And now we have about 15 projects that we've done around Mason County, and there are current projects back east, and using microfiltration to elimination of fecal coliform bacteria using wood chips and the garden giant mushroom. And it turned out that was the best species that we tested of the more than 20 that we put into this series of trials. This has led now to 3 peer-reviewed articles have been published, proving that microfiltration works, using wood chips to be able to capture nutrients, pollution, as well as biological contaminants such as E. coli. So we got very fascinated with this process because the mycelium selects out groups of bacteria that are beneficial to us. Well, we have the microbiome. I'm 100 trillion bacterial cells, you know, with 10 trillion Paul Stamets cells. And so this is lots of buzz about the microbiome. And so I thought, well, that's interesting. If we evolved and shared a common interest with fungi, what is the microbiome of the fungi that we're growing that looks so healthy? Because the baby in the bubble syndrome is what you have in the laboratory. But if you put the mycelium on the ground, organisms will gobble it up. So when you establish a group of beneficial bacteria that coexist with mycelium, it gives it a host defensive immunity against other pathogens, bacterial. So we did something here. It's not that complicated. We did next-gen sequencing. And we sequenced in the same wood chips that was grown, that was prepared by saltwater fermentation, freshwater fermentation after 2 weeks. Then we inoculated with two different species of mushrooms, and we found more than a 1,000-fold difference in the relative abundance of bacterial genera between the two colonies of mycelium that was perfectly happy and healthy, but the bacterial communities were distinct and unique. I think this is a first step in proving that there is a microbiome associated specifically with the mycelium that determines the downstream characteristics in the population of the bacterial communities that favors it in order to help it to grow, in order to benefit the plants that grow, that create the trees, and then create the debris fields that feed the mycelium. These are deterministic in the sequence of population of other organisms downstream from the inception of these saprophytic fungi, which are the first organisms to gobble, to attach to wood or dead debris as soon as it's being generated. So now, this is important also because E. coli is a pathogen. There are a lot of bacterial pathogens, and many forms of cancer are triggered from infection. About 12% of the cases of cancer are directly related to infection. We received a $2.2 million breast cancer clinical study grant from the National Institutes of Health in association with the Bastyr Medical School and the University of Minnesota Medical School. I was one of the principal investigators on the grant, one of the co-authors. We got the money. We were so excited. And then my co-PIs asked me, well, where should we get the mushrooms? I said, please get them from us. There's so many problems in this process, and we have chain of custody. We know it intimately well. Well, they said, you can't be a peer reviewer. You can't be a principal investigator and a supplier. Choose one. So I resigned as a principal investigator. We got the money. And then they had a jury. Well, how do we know that your mushrooms are better than mushrooms from China or elsewhere? So we got put into a pool. Thankfully, we got chosen as being number one. And so we was focused on turkey tail mushrooms, one of the best studied medicinal mushrooms in the world. And so we began this breast cancer clinical study. Now, 41% of you, on average, will get detectable cancer. 21% of you will die from cancer. About 73% of all cancer drugs come from natural products, something the pharmaceutical industry is reluctant to broadcast, but it's true. They are dependent upon nature. So the results of these studies I'm going to present now, and this is a phase one study with stage two and stage three breast cancer, and the dosage here is no mycelium of turkey tail, 3 grams and 6 grams, and so the immune system is augmented in a dose-dependent basis as you increase the amount. But directly after radiation therapy, your immune system is dramatically impaired. And so you're no longer able to produce as many natural killer cells and cytotoxic T cells, which is your frontline defenses against cancer. And then post-radiation at 1 week, 2 weeks, and at 4 weeks, there's a statistically significant increase on a dose-dependent basis. And those of you who know anything about stats, this is extremely significant, showing that the immune system is augmented specifically by the increasing the dose of taking turkey tail capsules. This is really fantastic news. Now, it was fantastic news until my mother called me up. And my mother called me up in June of 2009. I couldn't even understand who it was on the phone. She was crying. And I said, who is this? And she goes, it's your mom, Paul. I'm so worried. I'm so scared. My mother's a charismatic Christian. She has not seen a doctor since 1968. I said, what's wrong? And I thought she was in a car accident. And she said, my right breast is 5 times the size of my left. I have 6 angry lymph nodes on my right side. I'm worried. I'm scared. I go, oh, my gosh, Mom, why didn't you tell me sooner? I rushed her to Swedish Breast Cancer Clinic here in Seattle. Upon the second visit, we got the worst news that you could hear. The tumors, the cancer had crossed the meridian, invaded her sternum, went into her liver, and she had advanced stage 4 breast cancer. She was given less than 3 months to live. We sat down with the oncologist. He said, you know, you're too old for a mastectomy. We can't do radiation therapy because your immune system is so impaired. And she said, I see ladies in my 40s and 50s. And in fact, the oncologist said it's the second worst case of breast cancer she's seen in 20 years of practice. The tumor was erupting through her breast. We had the circle meeting. Some of you have gone through this. My mother chose a pine casket, a pink dress, the cheapest casket she could buy because she was going to the Lord. And she chose the hymns for a funeral. I mean, there was a lot of tears, a lot of holding of hands. And then we've been back to the oncologist, and she goes, you know, but if your immune system could kick this, and there's an interesting breast cancer clinical study going on at Bastyr Medical School at the University of Minnesota, and you might want to start taking turkey tail mushrooms. Well, my mother said, well, that's my son's been talking about that, but, you know, she had to hear it from a doctor. So my mother started taking 8 turkey tail capsules per day. She was put on Taxol, had a horrible reaction to it, refused to take it, and was put on Herceptin, a wonderful drug. She was taking turkey tail and Herceptin. She went back to Ellensburg, Washington. New Herceptin program was there. 50 ladies enrolled in that program. And that was in June of 2009. In January 2009, her tumors had all disappeared. And I'm happy to share this little message with you right now.
Thank you for your prayers. I love you, and I'll check in with you later. Bye-bye.
So my mother now is nearly 90 years of age. She's been tumor-free now for the past several years. And this story now has been written up in several medical journals, you know, as a best outcome case. And then an excellent article came out specifically showing that turkey tail compounds in combination with Herceptin enables Herceptin to work better as a chemotherapeutic drug. She had no chembrain, she had no nausea, she had no loss of appetite. And then she told me that the 48 women of the 50 women that entered the Herceptin program, 48 of them died. My mother was the only one taking turkey tail. One other lady, to the best of her knowledge, survived, is still with tumors. So this is, I think, potentially paradigm shifting. Now, the use of these medicinal mushrooms go back thousands of years, but then a series of articles started coming out. I'm a victim of Google alerts, Google Scholar alerts. I get way too many. I got 20 of them just about 5 minutes ago. But then it came out that it found out that the turkey tail mushrooms is a prebiotic for beneficial bacteria, Bifidobacterium and Acidophilus, down-regulating the inflammatory bacteria, up-regulating beneficial bacteria, helping the microbiome, which is where the majority of your immune system is first operational. And then Hayling Liu and I, it's a PhD and MD from the University of Washington Medical School. We wrote this great grant, unfortunately, because of the sequester. It did not get generated, but we wanted to create a standard protocol for all medicinal mushrooms throughout the world. So it's a great, great grant. I'll be glad to share it with any MDs or oncologists here in the audience. But then I really became focused on oncoviruses, viruses that cause cancer. There's 7 of them here. Most people know about hepatitis, you know, causing liver cancer, and HPV causing cervical cancer. But there's another cancer here that's called Merkel cell carcinoma that is caused by the polyoma virus. We all have it. But if you have a certain genetic constitution or makeup, you have 2 severe sunburns when you're a child, you have up to 75% chance of getting Merkel cell carcinoma. Well, only 10 people in the world have ever survived from Merkel cell carcinoma. And so very interestingly, the Fred Hutch Medical Center called me up and said, Paul, we need to talk to you. We have a very strange case. And I didn't even know about Merkel cell carcinoma. I went up and met with 20 oncologists and 5 histologists. And then there's a star phone in the center. And they said, we have a very unusual case. We need to talk to you about this person. A 58-year-old man is one of the 10 people in the world that totally lost all of his tumors. They highly metastasized all over his body. He did not want to tell them, the oncologists that were treating him, that he was taking medicinal mushrooms. And interestingly, when Julie Smith, my mother's oncologist, upon being interviewed and published in the medical journals, when she was asked if Patty, my mother, had told her oncologist she was taking turkey tail mushrooms, what would her oncologist have told her? Stop taking those mushrooms. Because they want to see if their protocol works, and because the abundance of caution and also the absence of knowledge, it's better for the doctors to play it safe, to say, don't take anything else, let my treatment, you know, take its course. Anyhow, this person was taking a 7-species mushroom blend, and it's been written up in the medical journals. We're real excited about this case, and Dr. Paul Nim is the principal oncologist at Fred Hutch doing this work. I call it the Nim hypothesis, and what he speculated is that the tumors evade detection by your immune system, and so even if you have an active immune system, you can't find docking points to lock and load to go into the tumors. With these mushrooms, putatively, what we believe it does is it decloaks the tumors for immune discovery. And it allows your immune system then to discover the tumors and cytotoxic T cells, natural killer cells, and a protein sequence called P53s, which causes the tumors to basically self-destruct. It's called apoptosis. And so we believe that these mushrooms are helping to unveil the tumors from immune discovery and also causes the tumors to self-destruct. So I became really interested. Wow, this virus-to-cancer connection. There's probably a lot more viral-to-cancer bridges that are out there because most viruses have not yet been identified. So some of my work then, you know, previously had focused on going into the old-growth forest and looking for particularly rare mushrooms. And I became very, very fascinated with agarikon. Agarikon, you know, it's very difficult to find. 1 out of 100 adventures into the old-growth forest, we might find them. Sometimes there's clusters and valleys, but oftentimes not. And so National Geographic gave me an award, and they want to do a story on me, on the search for agarikon, I mean, one of the rarest mushrooms in the world. So they sent a photojournalist, and we got a motor sailor with a Zodiac, and we went up the inland passage of Desolation Sound. Now he asked me, how likely is it we'd find agarikon? I said, oh, 50-50. It was an optimistic, you know, response. But I had good reason, because I brought 10 of my friends with high-powered binoculars, and he wanted to find a new discovery. He didn't want us to go to a place that we'd already been. He's a writer. And so we went and we looked on the horizon. We tried to find agarikon. They're often where bald eagles are, or snags, and you can see this big honeycomb thing. We looked. We got retina burn after a few hours. We got burned out. He was not very happy. He goes, I'm on deadline. I go, you're from New York. Be patient. So we decided, okay, well, what the heck, you know, so our skipper said, well, let's go over to an area and have a picnic. It's a First Nations site. It's a shamanistic site. No one really knows what the pictographs mean anymore, but it's a nice place to go over. And so we went over there. As we motored over there, then Jim Gouin, one of our team leaders, goes, there's one, and we find one. And this one fell from this branch, hit this branch, and then the mushroom regenerated mycelium, connected into the tree, and then it grew two legs. So really, no wonder it's called Elixirium ad longum vitam. So then Scott Franzblau came with me. He's the director of the Tuberculosis Research Institute at the University of Chicago. He's been funded by the Gates Foundation. So Scott came with me because he's very interested in Dioscorides' story of agarikon being active against consumption, later to be known as tuberculosis. Well, after about 7 or 8 years, Scott and I found, along with these other colleagues, the active constituents in agarikon active against tuberculosis. We published this in the Journal of Natural Products. And the compounds are coumarins, chlorinated coumarins. These are polyphenols. Yeah, and it's a very interesting group. And so we published this much longer after this trip, but while we were there, you know, we're there and we see this rock. And how bizarre. With this rock, and I'm looking at this rock, it looks strangely familiar to agarikon. So there's agarikon, there's a rock, there's agarikon, there's a rock. So how likely is it that we'd find agarikon? 1 out of 100. How likely is it to find it where there's pictographs, the First Nations, a shamanistic site? I don't know, 1 out of 10,000. How likely is it we'd find agarikon at that place, you know? Now, how likely is it we'd find it on my birthday? And that's when the photojournalist got really nervous and really nervous, and he goes, does this happen to Paul and Dusty often? And my friends looked at them deadpanned and said, yes. And I think this speaks to a higher truth. If you respect nature, if you respect indigenous peoples, if you pursue it because the knowledge is exciting, not because of your ego, then I think nature rewards you. And that is indeed the story of my life. So sometimes we have to go way up in trees to find agarikon. This is up on an island in British Columbia. This was the largest agarikon we've ever seen. It's about 70 years of age, until this guy sent us a picture from NorCal, California. Typical NorCal kind of guy, right? But this one's about 100 years in age. It weighs over 150 pounds. We asked him to send us a small piece of it. He sent us a chunk like this. So we were able to get it into culture. And we don't pick these unless it's being logged or there's a fire or, you know, with a housing development or something, the forest has been cut down. We GPS them. We take a small amount of tissue and we get it in the culture. Well, so I've been passionate about collecting agarikon for all these years. Now we have 77 strains of agarikon representing thousands of hours, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of research, just to bank these in the ecosystems before the ecosystems shrink or destroyed. Well, directly after, just before 9/11, I published this article in a peer-reviewed journal that was a summary of all the antiviral properties in mushrooms, a whole whopping one page long. That's all the scientific literature on the antiviral properties of mushrooms. Well, then 9/11 occurred, and some doctors from the BioShield Biodefense Program of the Department of Defense, was set up after 9/11, very concerned about bioterrorism. They saw this article and said, Paul, you know, why don't you submit some of your samples, you know, to the BioShield program? And that began a long odyssey. And the selectivity index is the indication of antiviral activity. Two is active. 10 is considered highly active. Well, we went through all this research, and it was a comedy of errors by the U.S. Defense Department. I don't want to humiliate them, but it is pretty damn funny what happened a few times. But then we got our research results. Our first 100 samples came back, and I'm going through this. I had massively high hits. I got, oh, my gosh. I called up the colonel of the U.S. Defense Department saying, these results are fantastic. And he goes, what results? I go, Federal Express just delivered me all these lab results. He goes, you're not supposed to get those. I go, no problem. I'll photocopy them and send them to you. Which I did. But then this resulted in a vetted press release from the Department of Defense. We had the best activity of more than 2 million samples, including pharmaceuticals, from a natural product, from the mycelium, a water ethanol extract. And you can listen to the NPR interview with myself, the deputy director of the FDA, and one of the heads of the BioShield program, saying this is really exciting. And then I was able to make the media-friendly statement, and it just came out one day, you know, this means that we should save the old-growth forest as a matter of national defense. You know, and so I'm very, very grateful to the U.S. Government and the Department of Defense and all of my colleagues that have walked this path with me. I may make fun of it, but humor is always nice. But there's some really serious people that are doing really good work. This is a summary of some of the extracts. This is the ribavirin, the positive drug control. Remember, anything over 10 is active. So here's our extracts, and they're 35% ethanol, so they have to be diluted 100-to-1 to be in contact with human cells, and those are our results. Against even H5N1, our SI numbers were more than 1,000, combining three of these mushrooms together, which indicates there's more than one antiviral substance that is co-occurring inside of these extracts, coming from those little droplets you saw in the microscopic slide, those little droplets of moisture coming from the mycelium. So I filed a patent on this in 2003, and the patent disappeared from the patent office. 5 years later, I'm talking to my patent attorney going, where the blast is my patent? And so he called up, got a hold of the patent office, and the U.S. Defense Department took the patent out of the patent office because of biosecurity. So they took it away. And so we had to do an intergovernmental agency trace, and finally the U.S. Defense Department released it. And so that was in 2003 into 2008. And then in July this last year, the patent office awarded me a patent of agarikon against flu viruses and pox viruses and against herpes and also against tuberculosis, E. coli, and staph. Now, that's really interesting because the majority of people that die from a flu infection die from actual bacterial pneumonia. And so your immune system's impaired, you have inflammation, all this water is being released, bacteria grow. And so to have something dually active against flu viruses and bacteria that can cause pneumonia is medically quite significant. So I gave this talk, or a talk similar to this, back in Washington, D.C., and scientists from Fort Detrick, which is, you know, our place where we have smallpox and do all this BioShield stuff, a number of the scientists came into the audience. And so they're in the audience, and then a group of Russians from Vector, that's the Fort Detrick of Russia, where they do all their top secret research, they came out with this paper, and they found that agarikon is highly active against flu viruses and pox viruses. It went through peer review. One of the peer reviewers go, hey, I saw Paul Stamos talk about this on his TED talk, you know, and so they had to give me credit. And so when I'm back in Washington, D.C. with the audience, and I said, you know, and we beat the Russians by 8 years, and a small cheer went up in the audience. So now the story gets very bizarre, and so we contacted NIH Virology last year, And we wrote into info@nih.virology.gov, and because they said, you know, yes, you can submit more samples for antiviral testing. And we sent in the email, and 17 minutes later, the director of NIH Virology personally wrote us back saying, you're cleared. We remember you. We'd love to have more samples, but we won't do bioprospecting. You have to send us in molecules. Well, it took Scott Fransblau and I and our team 6 or 7 years to do bioguided fractionation to find out the molecule that's active against TB. And so, like, what do I do? I mean, there's 200,000 substance compounds inside these mushrooms. Which one of them? I mean, I have no idea. I was doing natural extracts, and I thought, well, there's coumarins. They're so interesting. And then I started doing more and more research, and I don't know how to explain this because it doesn't really pass the logic test. I grabbed 20 polyphenols that are associated with the delignification of wood by Garrokon. I submitted 10 of those, and these are our results. We are more active than ribavirin, acyclovir, methylcytidine, interferon alpha, cidofovir, and falciparvir. I intuited it. These results came back from us about 2 months ago. And so I was able to navigate to active molecules. We submitted them. We wrote NIH saying, you know, we beat your positive controls on our first submission. And I said, will you please retest these? This is hard to believe. And then they said, why? Because I said, look up the results. They looked them up. They go, oh, my, this is really active. And I said, well, we want to make sure they're not false positives. And he says, they can't be false positive. We sent them to 4 different laboratories. So we asked them to resubmit. We got their first retest back 2 weeks ago, confirmation. So... I am not religious, but I am spiritual. I believe there's a new convergence of scientists who become spiritualized by falling in love with nature and understanding the importance of the world that's given them birth. And so now I'm going to tell you some strange stories. And my life is a series of strange stories. If only you knew. Mark Music knows a few of them. ask him. So, but this, that we only have 10 to 15% of the wood debris on the ground today than we did just a few hundred years ago. How is that impacting the ecosystem? 70% of soils are composed of microbial mass, and 40% of the organic mass is fungal. When you take away the wood debris, you're then taking away the menu for all these other organisms that are dependent upon the sequence of decomposition of mycelium spinning off all these nutrients. So I'm aware of this because of premature decline, 3 to 4 growths of monoculture trees in a forest. The trees topple over, the humus layer thins. You know, well aware of that. But a very weird thing happened. I was growing the garden giant mushroom, the same one that eliminates E. coli, and I had it in my garden. This is 1984, and I go out to my garden one day, and I see all these bees. And all these bees are moving the wood chips aside, and I looked at them really carefully, and I could see that they exposed the mycelium. These wood chips are like you moving a truck. I mean, they're huge compared to the bees, and they push the wood chips away to expose the mycelium, and I saw them sort of, you know, sip on the mycelium. And for 40 days, there was a convoy of bees from my 2 beehives to my garden, from dawn to dusk, all day long. And the bed of wood chips that was this thick got sucked down to this. And I thought, this is really weird. Well, maybe they're going after the sweet sugars that the mycelium is releasing, because mycelium makes a lot of sugars. So I put this in one of my books, Growing Gourmet and Medicinal Mushrooms. It was published in Harrow Smith magazine. Virtually everybody ignored me. There was a beekeeper in Ontario who wrote me, says, maybe that's why bees go to sawdust piles in the summertime. I had flowering plants all over my garden. The bees preferentially went to the mycelium. So I forgot about this, more or less. And then Louis Schwartzberg is a friend of mine. He's a Disney filmmaker. And he goes, Paul, I know you're doing work with fungi and insects, but what can you do to help the bees? I go, oh, the bees. Yeah, Louie, I had a very strange experience. Let me look at this. Let me think about this some more. There may be something going on here. And so because of Louie's questioning me, and I wanted to do something, I began to think. And my best thoughts come at awakening in the morning. I lay in bed an extra 5 or 10 minutes, and that very strange ethereal space between deep sleep and consciousness is a fertile ground for creativity. It's become a practice of mine. It's just, I'll meditate in that space. And I start thinking and thinking about the bees. Well, colony collapse disorder is a euphemism. It's a media-friendly little phrase, but the bees are dying really because of the mites and lots of other cofactors that are harming the immune system of the bees. Now, President Obama came out with a great presidential memorandum talking about the bees are being stressed because of poor nutrition, the forage lands are being cut down, the woods are being cut down, monoculture of plants, parasites, the mites are carrying viruses, and exposures to pesticides. Well, honeybees are heroic, but even more heroic are the native bees. Bumblebees, mason bees, 4,000 bees native to North America. The honeybee, Apis mellifera, came from Europe. Well, the other bees, the native bees, are servicing our ecosystem in ways that we can't even understand or barely imagine. But it's been said that with honeybees going into a field, a farmer's field, for instance, 80% of the pollination is coming from native bees. The honeybees are just contributing an extra 14 to 20%. So the bees are dying off. They're the proverbial canary in the coal mine. And as we rob in the carbon bank and destroy the humus and the saprophytic life cycles that are giving us all the food to all the other members in the community, we have changed the landscape in an unprecedented way. Here's a photograph from Whole Foods. This is what your dairy section would look like with bees, and this is what your dairy section will look like at Whole Foods without bees. It's a tremendous loss. It's said 40% of our food comes directly from bees pollinating the plants, and 70% indirectly comes from bees. So looking at these ecosystems, I had other thoughts. Dusty and my wife and I are hiking the old growth forest. We spend a lot of time there, and we oftentimes see bear scratches. Well, the bear scratched the trees, and in Mason County, my neighbor killed 400 bears hired by the timber industry because bear scratching trees cause fungal infections. Well, it turns out the bears scratch the trees, and then the resin from the trees is highly attractive to bees for getting propolis, which they use for patching their hives. And it also has antimicrobial properties. And so Dusty and I are hiking in the South Fork of the Ho River. We go around the corner, and she sees this bear scratch. And Paul, look at this. I go, oh, my gosh. It's the best photograph of a bear scratch I've ever seen. And the bear came up the tree and went, bam, scratch it like that. I said, well, this is really interesting because the timber industry says this foamy topsis mushroom related to agaricon is that's an entry wound that causes this mushroom to infect the tree, kill the tree. The tree dies. The timber industry now doesn't have the wood to mill into lumber. So they have an economic incentive for killing the bears or scratching the trees. They're bringing in the polypore mushrooms. So I said, that's an interesting theory, but let's go back. And so we went back 2 years later, and after a lot of searching, because this is the middle of the old growth forest, we find the original tree with a bear scratch in it. And sure enough, that tree fell down. This is the part of the standing up. And we look over, and that polypore mushroom that the timber industry and the Forest Service have been talking about was indeed growing from that tree. I went, wow, that's really interesting. And then, okay, so I had that in my mind. So I had this garden giant story, you know, in my mind. I had Louie telling what can you do with the bees. I had the bear scratches, and I know that the bears would create resin that bees would go after the propolis. There was some connection there. And then I'm a voracious reader of scientific literature. And then this article came out, and it turned out that the bees that suffer from colony collapse. Now, bear in mind, what happens is the bees leave and they don't come back. And there are nurse bees taking care of the brood, but when the worker bees go out, the foraging bees, when they're flapping, you see bees around flowers at the end of their life. They flap their wings until they're shredded. They're bringing back pollen to the hive, but they're at the very end of their life. But when they don't come back, the nurse bees then are prematurely recruited to become foraging bees to replace the workers that didn't come back. So eventually you have the nurse bees abandoning the hive. As a result, the mites there that would otherwise be mitigated by the nurse bees and other factors, they're injecting viruses into the young bees. And so then this article came out saying, oh my, that they looked at the honey in these hives where the bees had been abandoned, and it's lacking an interesting coumarin, p-cumaric acid. I said, wow, that's interesting. Scott and I were talking about coumarins with the anti-tubercular properties. And it turns out that p-cumaric acid upregulates the cytochrome P450 pathway. We all animals use it. You have it mostly in your liver. It breaks down toxins. And bees only have 47 of these genes. Humans have 60. Most insects have 80. And it turns out that the lack of these fungally produced coumarins turns off the detoxification pathways in the bees, and now the neonicotinoids, the glyphosates, all these pesticides and herbicides are hyperaccumulating in the bees, causing them to have malaise, impairing their immune system. Mites are biting them, and now viruses are proliferating out of control, and so it's a perfect storm. So then another article came out, and it turned out that sublethal doses of these insecticides, which were only studied one at a time by the EPA, but not in combination, then has a dramatically negative effect on bee survival. And then another article came out that's showing the use of fungicides around these fields defeat the fungi that then don't have the p-cumaric acid compounds giving to the bees, so their detoxification pathways are not turned on. So all these things coming together, and I'm thinking, wow, I think I can do something about this. And so most commercial honey beekeepers use sugar water, and they put it into to supplement to help to replace the honey that they're taking and also help the bees to be healthy as a food source. It's 50% water, 50% sugar. So I thought, well, okay, if I can get these coumarins being produced, and some of these mushrooms have antiviral properties, maybe we should start working on coming to come up with something that can help the bees. So David Summerlin and my other teammates and myself, we created Myco Honey. This is mycelium-based only. There's no added sugar. This is a mycelial honey material. We got real excited about this. I contacted several universities, and when I went to Steve Shepard at Washington State University, he said, stop, don't go anywhere else. And so then we set up a series of experiments at WSU and started feeding the bees the mycelial extracts, the myco honey. And there's one clear tube, that's sugar water, and the other tubes have the various concentrations of our extracts that are put in with the bees. So we surveyed 20 species, and the bees love it. Now, this is their captive experiments. The bees only live about 30 days in captivity. That's typical for bees, pretty much, except for in the overwintering times. And so we started playing around, and then the results came back on a stress test for longevity as well as antiviral activity. And this gets very strange. It turns out bees are attracted to young fir trees, scratches, and to birch trees and other species in the Populaceae that are related, like poplars and willow trees. Our results came back, and we found that the red-belted polypore, the same one the bear scratches the trees and the mushroom comes out, that's the one, the red-belted polypore, chaga, which we found with the BioShield program, is strongly antiviral against flu viruses, also against other viruses, and amadou, the mushroom my hat, came from, which is the first source of an antiviral against the tobacco mosaic virus, and reishi mushrooms turn out to be extremely beneficial to the bees. All four of these species grow on birch trees. Two of these species grow on fir trees. So we started doing the research, the results, And this is over about a year's time. And Dr. Steve Shepard, with 39 years of experience studying bees, he's never seen anything like this, where the bees, the longevity of the bees was increased. And this difference here is huge, because this means that the foraging bees can go out and do their job at the time when the colony is most dependent upon them. So we went, wow, this is really a longevity test. This is great. It increases the longevity of the bees. So then we looked at the red-belted polypore. We found that different concentrations then would extend the life of the bees significantly. So as we diluted the extracts, they became more potent for the bees. This is wonderful from a production point of view because we just add water, you know. So the more diluted it is, the more potent it is. So it's so we found that, wow, the red-belted polypore and chaga extends the livelihood of bees. So then we started looking at bee viruses. And the bee viruses in the control, from 1 week to the next week, the viruses, you know, skyrocket. And then on a dose-dependent basis with the chaga extract, the viruses then would decline as we increase the concentration. So we had increase in longevity and we had decrease in viruses. And so then we looked at the antiviral properties of the red reishi mushroom that also grows on birch trees. Similar situation. The virus controls go up, and then as you increase the concentration of the extract, the viruses plummet. And it is thought that the mites carrying the viruses really do the bees in. So the summary of this is that with the controls, the viruses increase dramatically. With these extracts, the viruses then plummet. So now, this is so strange because we all grew up with Winnie the Pooh. We all knew that bears would go into logs to get honey from bees' nests. I've given several talks to huge audiences, the North American Mycological Association and the American Bee Association, and I asked them, has anyone here ever heard of bees being attracted to mycelium? Anywhere in the scientific literature? Any public talk? No one. No one. Hiding in plain sight. We don't know the way of the bee, and the bees are attracted, I believe, to logs for immunological benefit. Not only getting the sugars, but getting the upregulating compounds that cause the detoxification pathways. You have the antiviral properties. So we started reimagining, well, maybe we could reinvent the beehive. And would make the beehive made of mycelium. Because all beehives after about 5 years have to be replaced. They get black molds. Those are also toxic to bees. What if the beehives, as they mature, actually then the mycelium grows. And it helps the bees' immunity and helps their longevity. So there's so many things that I think that we can possibly do. So in summary, I want to just that humans, trees, bears, mushrooms, all terrestrial organisms are interconnected within the mycelial web of life. Now think of the implications of this. Chaga, reishi, and some of the other mushrooms that I mentioned are active against viruses that harm humans, H5N1, H1N1. Oh, H1N1 harms pigs. H5N1 is bird flu. The same mushrooms are active against viruses that harm humans, birds, pigs, bats carrying Ebola, and bees. This could be a fundamental breakthrough and understand something foundational about the ecosystems that have given us life. That the mycelium in the ecosystem is controlling the immunological health of the inhabitants that walk upon this mycelial mats. And if this is true, which I think it is, this also speaks to the fact when a carrying organism exceeds the carrying capacity of its ecosystem, diseases proliferate, knocks down the virulent organism. And I think this thing speaks to where we need to really focus as we go into the future, understanding that we are all interconnected. We live within these mycelial membranes. We live in these networks of information, networks of immunity, networks of food, and our food security is so dependent upon these other organisms. But we are so blind. And it's not surprising that some of these mushrooms are more familiar to scientists. Many of these mushrooms are so perishable, they disappear in 5 days. When you have mushrooms that can feed you, that can kill you, that can make you high, that can heal you, and it's only in your visual viewscape for a few days. You know, that compare that to animals and plants that you were in a viewscape for months, years. And so it's naturally for humans to avoid that which is powerful, but that it's mysterious to them. But we have come to a threshold of knowledge now that I think all of us can participate in helping bees by engaging in decomposition cycles of wood. Don't export it. Let it sit on the ground. Let it rot. And maybe we should all become a lot more bee mushroomed. And scientists should work across disciplines, because biodiversity is our biosecurity. And I believe habitats have immune systems, and mycelial networks are the cellular bridges that connect us all. We all are actively engaged in the microbiome, the exobiome outside of your body, the microbiome within. But these are just membranes that are highly permeable. We're all involved in biomolecular communication with each other. The fact that you're here in this room with me and some of my associates here means that we have brought in fungal populations to spread them all to you. So I want just to leave you with this little short that Louis Schwartzberg and I are putting together a movie, and I think it says a lot. Louis and I were in the old growth forest for 8 hours. He showed this to some Hollywood directors, and they said, "Great writing, who wrote it?" And Louis laughed. He goes, "Paul doesn't read, he just says this." So, but I spoke from the heart, and I think it's a message that I think it rings true for a lot of us. Mushroom mycelium represents rebirth, rejuvenation, regeneration. Fungi generate soil that gives life. The task that we face today is to understand the language of nature. My mission is to discover the language of nature of the fungal networks that communicate with the ecosystem. And I believe nature is intelligent. The fact that we lack the language skills to communicate with nature does not impugn the concept that nature is intelligent. It speaks to our inadequacy for communication. If we don't get our act together and come in commonality and understanding with the organisms that sustain us today, not only will we destroy those organisms, but we will destroy ourselves. We need to have a paradigm shift in our consciousness. What will it take to achieve that? If I die trying, but I'm inadequate to the task to make a course change in the evolution of life on this planet, okay, I tried. The fact is, I tried. How many people are not trying? If you knew that every breath you took could save hundreds of lives into the future, had you walked down this path of knowledge, wouldn't you run down that path of knowledge as fast as you could? I believe nature is a force of good. Good is not only a concept, it is a spirit. And so hopefully the spirit of goodness will survive. Thank you very much, folks.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you value this episode or this series, please share your appreciation by posting a good review. It'll help more people find us. Paul Stamets is a renowned mycologist, author, and advocate for bioremediation and medicinal mushrooms. His work was featured in the documentary film The 11th Hour. Stamets spoke at Town Hall Seattle on May 4th, 2015. At an event hosted by The Common Acre. Thanks again to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. Tune in next week for more great talks. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.